You are listening to the In Context podcast.
Hello and welcome to the In Context podcast. This episode will be focusing on being a father to the fatherless, the need for mentors, godly influences and role models in the lives of young men and boys who are being raised in fatherless families. We'll look at one particular case of Ben Falaja, a former amateur boxer and fatherless young man who grew up on a council estate in the 90s, who was being mentored and supported by Eric Young, who is a retired policeman and former professional footballer. We hope that this will give you an insight into some of the struggles that young men and boys face while being raised into a fatherless family. But what we're also hoping to do is encourage godly men to take a stand and to stand up in the church and help support these young men who are desperate for role models in their life. I hope you enjoy.
So growing up, obviously, 90s, you know, just like most council estates, really, people pinching cars and all that type of stuff. You know, local people selling drugs on the street, families, a lot of families, well-known families, big families, living on the estate and all the brothers and stuff like that. So yeah, growing up for me, I think I was one of, there was my sister, my cousin, and then only another one other lad who was mixed race, living on the estate. So yeah, so growing up on the estate was quite, well, I was a minority, but it was tough. I mean, my mum brought me and my sister up. My dad didn't live with us, so which is even stranger. It was all, my mum was white. So yeah, didn't have any like role models like of colour really. So it was hard, it was tough, yeah, but you just try to survive, you know. I think growing up and that, people want to pick out your flaws, don't you? And so, you know, if you're scruffy or if you're black or if you're overweight or whatever it is, kids and that, they try and put you down and whatever. And you know, I was black, so we used to get a lot of name calling, even off men. I remember our mum's quiet, she's about 4 foot. And when she moved onto the estate, one of the things my auntie said to me was, oh, that's when she became tough. Because of some of the abuse that we got as kids off. So like say if we were playing knocky knocky hard or whatever, so there'd be me, two other lads, both white, I'd knock on the door and run off, and then it'd be like, oh, was that black lad, this, you know, and then it'd be the name and that, and then our mum would go around, you know. So yeah, but it was hard, it was tough. You know, I was always fighting because of people calling me names and what have you. But you just sort of did what you did to survive. But I grew up with a lot of anger because of that. And I think a lot of that was, you know, blame my dad, not being around. I think me being of colour was one thing, but then also not having like a dad to sort of be there and sort of go around and say, listen, you know, this has gone on. It made me become, thinking I had to be a man at an earlier age than what, you know, many other people probably would have had to do.
Yeah, so you felt the need to grow up quick and, yeah, trying to be a man with a kid's mind and a kid's body. It's tough growing up without a dad, never mind wherever you live, but never mind being a minority living on a tough council estate where you were up for bullying and racism and stuff like that. But, yeah, it made you tough. It made you aggressive. So how did you channel that aggression?
Well, like I say, at first it was like anyone would look at me, it'd be like, and this is what happened. Like in my head, I was thinking people were looking at me because I was black, and sometimes they probably weren't. But in my head, it was like, yep, they're looking at me because I'm black. Right, who are you looking at? So I was always trying to get them on the back foot. Because when you were saying earlier about role models, I remember going in primary school, there was one other black lad, and he was the you know, he sort of ran the school, and he was a black lad. And I remember thinking, like, no one ever gave him any chew because he had this mad respect. You know, everyone didn't really go near him or just call him names or whatever because he had this respect because he could handle himself. So I remember thinking, you know, if I become like him and I can, because he, you know, he's the same colour as me, you know, life will be easier. So, you know, I anger was always there. It was there. I'd be walking around with a frown. Wife's just walked in there. I forgot to tell her I was doing this. All right, babe. I'm on the thing with Ian, podcast thing. All right. So it was hard. It was tough. So then I just, like I say, I was angry all the time, fighting all the time. And then obviously I started getting into boxing when I got a little bit older. But before then, because a lot of the older lads who was on the estates, once I started to get a reputation and that, I started like wanting to be like them, selling drugs, doing stuff like that. And started taking drugs, really, got addicted, and just got pulled into the crowd and made a bit of a name for myself, and life was a bit easier, I guess. And then about 17, I just did a low, all-time low. The only time I heard about Jesus when the pastor used to come into school and talk about God and that. And when he used to pray, I used to believe it. And he used to talk about the Good Samaritan and about we should help each other, people who aren't like us and stuff like that. But when I go back to my counsellor state, it wasn't like that. It was like, you know, do a sort of die. And then I was fortunate walking to a boxing gym one day to try, and I wanted to get off drugs and that. So I went in, started punching the bag, and my coach just said, oh, you know, stick at it, and that you know, you could maybe do well. So I just kept going, and that was it. And at that time, I just started praying as well to God, just saying, you know, I was sick of my life, wanted to be different, but I didn't know how to change, wanted to not be like the other lads that like, I sort of looked up to. I just cried out to God, really, and he heard my prayer, and there was a Christian at the boxing gym who I ended up getting to know, and then ended up going to church and then becoming a Christian.
So you did well at your boxing, didn't you? You channeled that aggression. You not only did you become a Christian, but you boxed for England, and did you box for Great Britain as well?
Yeah, no, I boxed for England, yeah. So, really, it was a bit strange because I come to the game later when you're thinking about boxing wise. I came at 17, but you know, I had, like you say, challenging all that, like, I don't know, like that anger and stuff. It was good for me, and it taught me a lot about myself, because I remember one fight when I went in, and my thing, I was like quite, you know, I was quite good at moving and boxing, quick feet and all that. But I remember one time I was boxing this lad, and he was he could hit hard and that, and every time I used to get angry, and I used to think, right, you're getting it now. I used to get beat, so I used to, over time, the anger was like, it was a bit of something that needed to be sort of harnessed rather than just, all right, yeah, you know, go. So I did all right, yeah. So I ended up boxing for England, went to Ireland, travelled the world, boxed some of the lads who are boxing now, Anthony Fowler, James Metcalf, and Glenn Forty when he was about, yeah, and got to a good level, you know, number three in England, number four in Britain, and yeah, I was blessed really to be able to have that career that I had.
Discipleship for both of us, I think, coming from our backgrounds, was quite a struggle, because when we share with people, a lot of them didn't understand not just our temptations, but we were quite often led by emotion. Like you say, anger. I grew up with a lot of fear, and I didn't really have anyone to mentor me or help me until I met a guy called Graham Seed, and then I met you shortly afterwards. And so we had, we weren't that much. I was about 10 years or so age between us, and I come from a similar background. So we had more in common than I suppose you and Eric did, but you and Eric seemed to hit it off quite well. So, but he had nothing to do with drugs. He just retired as a cop. He was a policeman. He was white. So how come you two, who on paper probably would be the furthest away from being friends. You end up becoming really good friends, haven't you? How did that friendship develop then?
Definitely, or Eric.
Whoever wants to jump in.
Go on, Eric. I'll let you.
Well, I would say, like with Ben and a lot of lads like that, through football, you meet a lot of lads, you play with a lot of lads from a similar background. I mean, I'm from a council estate. You know, we never had any money growing up, never had nothing. But the characters I met in football were very much like the characters I dealt with in the police, you know, the young offenders and that kind of people. And in football, you know, your Gaza types, if it wasn't for football, they may have ended up in that kind of life. So I could banter on with a lot of people like that when I was in the job in the police, you know, and I used to, well, you know, so you came across so many from broken homes, and you could see they were crying out for a father figure. There was no men in their lives. And so in the police, I started to try and just speak to these lads on a normal one-to-one basis and just try to get through to them as like a father figure. Why were they doing what they were doing? That kind of thing. So meeting Ben, it just sort of carried on from there. And Ben, as you know, he needs telling a few times. I thought, what the heck am I doing here? You know, he listened and it was good because it just, we bounced off one another. You just can't make that happen. It just happens.
Well, you both had a similar love for sport, don't you? You're both very sporty.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about your upbringing then with football.
Well, right from a kid, I was kicking a football about. I loved it. And as I say, on a council estate. Now, you've got to bear in mind, when I grew up, it was 50s and 60s. Ben there was the 90s. Where I grew up, I knew everybody in the street. Everybody had a mother and father there. And everybody was in work. Mainly the mothers were housewives, so there was always someone at home. And life was different in that way. I had a great childhood. We were taught sort of standards, morals, how to behave. I went to Roman Catholic school, so we got all the biblical teaching and background, went to church every Sunday, generally good people. So, I mean, I was playing football, and eventually I was playing for Stockton Boys. And
here, Eric, I've never asked you this. Was, you know, on your estate then, was there any black lads on your, like, when you were growing up?
No, there were no black people, no. But you're going on about racism then. I heard you talking earlier. You used to take the mickey out of somebody who was overweight. I would say fat people. Yeah. Well, I had, like, ginger hair.
Did you?
Yeah. Well, you think you're
a Portuguese. You would have got it.
So, you know, you all have a little bit of, you know, I was different to a lot of lads in that respect. So, you know, you have to cope with that as well. But I went 15, you know, I got into the England schoolboys. The team was always Manchester United. And, of course, when they offered to come to go there, well, you snap it up, don't you? Mm-hmm.
So what was it like then in Manchester? Your dream come true? Was it as glamorous as you thought it was going to be, getting signed for Man United?
Oh, well, I could talk all night about that, but I'll try and keep it brief. But just, you've got to remember, just before I left home, a 15-year-old, remember, yeah. It's like going into foster care, you go into digs. Mm-hmm. But you have this sort of idealistic idea in your head, don't you? But my sister was only 23 and just died at that time, just before I left. And she'd had a kidney removed when she was 11 years old. So when I grew up, there was an 8-year age gap. When I grew up, she was always taking medication, but she went on to be a school teacher. She was teaching art at a local school. And sometimes she wouldn't be able to sleep. She'd get up in the night. My mother would get up with her and she'd sleep on the settee downstairs and we'd get up for school. And this particular morning, I was going to school and I said, "Oh, be quiet, Dawn," they called her. She's asleep on the sofa. And I looked back, saw her with her back to me, laid on the sofa asleep. And that day at school, I was called out of class and told she'd died. So I'm stood at a graveside watching her being buried as I'm just about to leave home to go to Manchester and start a professional career with Manchester United. But I had those thoughts in my head of, what's this all about, this life, you know? So I went to Manchester and I was homesick, very homesick, as most kids are when you go away. I was apprentice at first, but it was brilliant, the football side of it. But away from football, it was horrible. Just didn't like it at all. So I had to cope with that. And of course, by the time I was 16, my dad, who was only 47, he took ill, and very quickly he died. And I was back at the same graveside, watching the coffin being lowered into the same grave where Dawn was. And you don't realise at the time then, but things were happening in my head where football was everything to me. But what was going on was saying it's not a matter of life and death, football, as Bill Shankly said. I was looking at it in reality, thinking, what's this life all about, you know? So it was difficult when I went away and having to cope with all that. My mother, of course, was left on her own trying to cope. And she never, you know, she had to go get a full-time job. So in my formative years, I had all these heavy things to deal with when I should have been sort of being a bit happy-go-lucky and enjoying life. But there was all this going on. Talk about having to grow up quickly. But I had no father figure as well. He was very close with me, mentoring me and talking football at length. And I missed that because you don't realise, but you're trying to, like a kid is doing something, you say, was that good, Dad? Was that good, Dad? You know, wanting that affirmation all the time. And of course, he wasn't there, and I knew how proud he was of me being there. And that's right, I had to cope with that. Made a lot of mistakes, but I had to learn from my mistakes. It was tough. I don't know, I could talk at length. I don't know where you want me to go with that.
Yeah, again, it's just interesting to hear you speak about fatherlessness comes from lots of reasons, doesn't it? So automatically we think of a father leaving the children, which happens in a lot of cases, but death, imprisonment, the wife leaving the husband, kids are without fathers for lots of reasons. So I think it's interesting to hear. I think it's always painful, but it affects you in different ways.
When we were growing up, you never heard of people divorcing. It just wasn't an acceptable thing to do. It was only film stars you'd hear of splitting up. So it was a different world then.
Yeah.
You know, whereas today, if it's tough, people think, oh, I'll just split up. But then you got on with it, you got over it. And I just often think, well, how much were marriages strengthened by going through that, rather than quitting at the first hurdle kind of thing that seems to happen today?
So on first sight, you looked at the 2 years, and you'd probably think there's not much in common there between a retired copper and an ex-drug taker, but a lot of similarities growing up. Both loved your sport, both having to deal with not having a father around to guide you and direct you. So how did you then move on from football into the career that you had? Because you too have been around the world because of the sport, haven't you?
Yeah, well, you know, I won't go into the length, but I was quite disillusioned with the football. And we had a lot of changes of managers at the time because Matt Busby was the manager when I first joined them. They just won the European Cup. So we then had a succession of different managers, which is like when after Alex Ferguson retired, the same things happened there. I can see the similarities in the. And your progress is halted because a new man comes in, wants to bring other people in. And I went on to play for the England under-19s, and I was starting to get in the squad with manager Frank O'Farrell. Then the opportunity went to go on loan somewhere, and he said to go there, come back and get the experience. But at the moment, we're struggling a little bit, and I can't afford to experiment, but you're very much part of my future plans. So I went on loan to a club for 2 months, and in the first 2 weeks, O'Farrell was sacked and Tommy Docherty took over. My career was flipped upside down. Anyway, the long and the short of it was, my contract was coming up, and I'd even asked to leave the club because I didn't like the way I was being treated, so I asked to leave. And I then decided that if I wasn't going to play for United, I was going to take another step elsewhere, and I was thinking of doing PE teaching. And I was lined up to do that. But then something else came up. It was a course in recreation management, sports centre management. And that was part-time. And I'd had an offer just to play with a local club, Darlington. So I thought, well, I'll get a wage coming in playing for Darlington and I'll just concentrate on doing this course, thinking of a way to get out of the game. And I ended up doing 4 years at Darlington. And then when I was planning to get married, I decided to turn the contract offer down and quit. Went to Whitby Town as a joint coach with a lad I knew, and got a job working for KP Foods, crisps and nuts, selling things like that. Thinking, oh, just get a job and play football as long as I'm playing football. But it wasn't long. It hit me like a train, the job I was doing, and how much I missed football. And I could have still been playing pro. I know that. Willie Madgen come to Whitby. You know, he went on to manage Middlesbrough and an ex-player at Middlesbrough. And he said to me at Whitby, he said, Eric, you should still be playing pro. And I knew that. Anyway, the long shot was I got an offer to go to Australia as a player coach. So I decided to go for it. And me and my wife went over there. And then we came back after 4 years after getting residency. She was pregnant and we came back. And then I was in the same position again. What work was I going to do? And the end of it, a chance come to go into the police, applied for it. Really deep down thinking, this is not me. But getting married and the responsibilities. And next thing you know, I'm at training school with this big hat on my head, playing like chocolate soldiers marching around thinking, what am I doing here? But it turned out to be a good, secure job. It was different. You're out and about, and persevered with it.
Eric, do you reckon you'd have caught me? If you'd have chased me, you wouldn't have caught me.
No, you'd be the one. You'd be like all the others. Were like, it's like a turnstile at the police station. In one way, out the next, back in
you,
again.
You wouldn't have caught me over them fences. If I was jumping them fences, you wouldn't have caught me. I know, sir. In fact, you wouldn't have.
He'd have caught me. Have you seen Hot Fuzz? All right, that copper who goes through the fences.
So yeah, police. And I when I retired from the police, was retiring, the end of my career, I started doing football with kids on the streets. Yeah. You know, sick of chasing them around. So I started rounding them up and organising football matches for them, and it was working. And the kids were all saying, oh, I'd rather do this than hang around the streets. You know, we're getting the ones we were always chasing, playing football, and it was good. And I thought, well, that's worthwhile, you know, because it's... And I wondered if I'd carry on doing something like that when I retired in some capacity. But the last thing I wanted to do, I wanted to get as far away from police stuff as I could. Hmm. And as you know, I ended up going to the prison ministry, meeting Ben, thinking, what am I doing? I want to get away from people like this.
And how did you find that, Eric? Because... Yeah, that's when the three of us met. We were working for Sown Seeds Prison Ministry. We were going into different young offenders and the adult prisons and flipping heck, mate. Like, I was just thinking there about Ben, you walking into the prison with your phone on and it rang. And like, about 20 prisoners wanted to dive on you for the phone.
I know, yeah. I didn't realise, did I? And you were like, Ben, you can't have your phone in here. I was like, yeah.
Well, I was going to say there, it's funny how to get involved. Yeah, that was it. I could have gone in with a Christian ministry that offered me a job. Said, anytime, just you can come and join us. We'll give you your own office. You organise things. But they were dealing with kids from the age of 7 to 14 doing soccer schools, and they'd go abroad to do things as well. But they were generally church kids, all nice kids. And I thought, well, really, the ones you want to be trying to get hold of are the 14 to 17-year-olds who start to go off the way, you know. And so it wasn't really attractive to me. So the chance to go into the prisons and start doing a bit of football with the kids in there seemed worthwhile. You know, trying to teach them the skills you need for sport are the same skills you need in life, really. Trying to pass that on.
It's funny because me and Ben were working in the prison ministry, but we were still pretty new Christians. I got saved in 2003, so I think I'd only been a Christian four years. You were only a new Christian. Were you saved around a similar time, Ben?
or were you later?
Oh, a bit after, later than you, yeah. When did we meet?
It'd have been about 2006.
Yeah, so I'd maybe, yeah, so yeah, about 2006, 2007, I think.
Yeah. So again, like both brand new Christians, so we were out preaching the gospel with these offenders and prisoners and people in the community, but we were still struggling with our own issues, dealing with some of the pain from the past, but also still struggling with various sins and addictions. And yeah, it was, I look back, it was mental, wasn't it? It was brilliant. But I think from playing football with these offenders in the prison, then remember when we were doing that outreach with the jiu-jitsu, and then the instructor started choking that lad out from Paul.
You were like, I think he's had enough now. I think he's had enough. And like, he started fitting on the floor. And
it was, you know, like when you think, I need to do something here, but I don't want to because he might batter me as well.
He looked at me, he said he's choking, he's not going to let go. I said, I know. And I thought, yeah. Oh. What was I thinking of there? There was too many stories. It was good. I was going boxing and news had come, babysit me to make sure I wasn't getting into, you know, hoping all good and stuff like that. And, you know,
so how was that for you? Well, explain, because I remember there was one night you were at the Reebok Arena in Bolton fighting on a Ricky Hatton show, and you rang me and said, you're going to have to get yourself down here. So I rang Eric, I said, do you fancy your trip to see Ben?
Yeah, yeah. Well, that was it. I mean, obviously, boxing, getting to a certain high level, you get a lot, you know, attention and that, and there's a lot of ego that comes with it, and, you know, you go on to shows and there's ring girls and that type of stuff, and even after you've been in the training camp for weeks and that, you know, and you're just constantly training, dieting, making weight, cutting weight, and then the next thing, you know, you're building up this big sort of event, this fight, and you know, it's tough. I remember that when I met Nigel Benn, he said to me, you know, boxing's not for a Christian. He opened up about when he was boxing and how, you know, women would turn up at his door and you know, he was married and loads of stuff like that. And, you know, that's why a lot of the time I'd take someone with me, yourself, Tony or Eric, I'd ring you and say, listen, you need to come here, because it was just there, you know what I mean? It was an atmosphere. And a lot of the boxers weren't Christians. So I used to take my Bible, I used to be reading my Bible. But it's just, I don't know, it was just the atmosphere. It was tough. But again, having like Savedic there and yourself, you know, who were Christians, also with a similar background, and faced, you know, in the sport environment, surrounded by non-Christians, it was easy. It was easy working. It wasn't easy, but in the prison ministries, because you were surrounded by Christians. But when you're not, and you're put into an arena where you're the Christian, and it's a bit early. And I remember, you know, that time when that reporter asked me when I was doing an interview, and I was just saying to him, I want to thank God. And he was like, yeah. You know what I mean? People like were looking at me as if I was odd, and I probably was a bit odd, but you know, it was tough, you know, you still had them battles. I still had them battles about, I wanted to go out and drink, then I'd go out in Middlesbrough. Middlesbrough's only a short place. So when you're in the Gazette nearly every, you know, month, because you're achieving these things and you're tipped to go to the Olympics or the Commonwealth Games, you know, everyone wants a little piece of you, don't they? Do you know what I mean? I don't know what it's like for you, Eric, but everyone's like, you know, everyone's your best mate and that. And you're going into pubs or restaurants and people are like, all right, yeah. And it does sort of feed into you. But at the time, to keep me sort of grounded, having the likes of yourself and Eric around me, you know, just kept me sort of, you know, straight. So, you know, that's part of having that sort of fellowship and that discipleship, isn't it?
Well, just saying.
In the football world, it's the same, you know, you just, everybody wants to be your pal. Mm. And you don't know who's a genuine friend.
Mm.
I didn't like that. I'd rather be with the real people.
Yeah.
But you had a passion for football, didn't you? That was like a dream.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Still am, you know, but,
yeah.
I mean, talk about idolatry. You know, Dennis Law was my player, you know what I mean? And there he was picking me up for training. And I actually had my tag one season. I was next to him. We'd get changed together in the morning, going for training. And I just had to pinch myself every morning. It was unreal. It was great.
So how did that affect you? Because, Ben, it was a massive idol for you that you'd a lot of these lads had been training at Loughborough. You were working on a building site all day and training on a night in a dirty little gym over the border in Middlesbrough. And then you were up there competing with some of the best who were training full time. And that dream of the 2012 Olympics, of fighting there. Explain a little bit about your dream to get there and then your opportunity to get there and why you never ended up there.
Yeah, I think, like, Eric, I mean, for me, what happened over time is you start to think, so focused, like it was an idol, you know, becoming an idol, like this was my career, you know. This is, even though, like you said, I was doing a plumbing apprenticeship, so I'd go and do a plumbing apprenticeship. I'd get changed in these horrible bus station toilets. It was horrible. It stunk. Absolutely stunk. I used to think, the councils don't clean these toilets, you know. I used to go in there, quickly get changed, and then I'd run to the gym, and that was just went on and on and on. And then as I started to do better, I was thinking people, like you say, other people at that level were, you know, getting sponsored and whatever. I started to think, right, you know, am I going to go for this? And I sort of did. I thought, right, yeah, let's go for it and see what happens. And it just that was it. I planned, this is my career, this is where I want to go. I was up there competing whether I was going to go to the 2012 Olympics, and then I didn't get the nod, and then I started looking into maybe being able to box for my dad's sort of country, Nigeria, and I was offered to go over there, which was a bit mental. So I went. So I was offered by Repton, which is the most prestigious club. In one of the most prestigious clubs in the world. I think it's been going since the Craze went there, Tom Hardy went there, Ray Winston, some well-known people went to Repton Boxing Gym. And then I was invited down to go to there. So I ended up going down there, and I was obviously a northerner, and they're all like Cockney lads. So I goes down there, and they made me feel at home, like, you know, give me a tracksuit and all that, and said, listen, you know, I'm going to go over there. The Nigerian Boxing Federation will have a look at you, and if they like what they'll see, you know, you'll be able to go back and to, you know, train for the 2012 Olympics. So I ended up going over there. It was definitely the Lord that, you know, he planned it, he orchestrated it, because I hadn't seen my dad at that point for like, I think it was like maybe 12 years, something mad like that. And spoke with him or anything. And I just felt God saying, you know, I'd forgiven my father for not being there and stuff like that. And I felt God saying to me, giving me peace about going out there and just message my dad and just say, listen, Dad, I'm coming out to Nigeria. And, you know, I'd like to meet up with you. So he was like, oh, really, yeah. So anyway, goes over there. And obviously, you treat like celebrities, really. We had armed guards everywhere we went. You know, blue lights everywhere. You know, and we'd be escorted into this hotel. The vehicles would be getting checked for, I don't know, bombs or whatever. And then we went to stay at this proper fancy hotel. And my dad came down, and I was able to just say, look, Dad, I found the Lord, you know. Jesus has saved me. I was living like this. And doing this way, but God met me where I was and he changed me, and I held a lot of anger towards you. I just opened up and said, look, I forgive you. And that just sparked man his relationship. There was a lot of God done a lot of reconciliation in that process. Anyway, I boxed, did well, beat one of the Commonwealth lads, one of the Nigerian lads who beat the Commonwealth Games, beat him, and then come back home, and then I was doing this Christian Daniel challenge with the Oakwood Centre, and it was about giving a year to God. So I come home, I thought, right, I'm going to give a year to God. But then I got a message off the Nigerian Box Federation saying, look, we want you to come out, we want you to do some training, and we're going to back you to go into the African nations and then go over to, you know, competing in the Commonwealth and stuff like that. And it was at that moment where I had a choice, really, whether I go or whether I don't. And I just prayed about it, and I just felt it wasn't right, really. I felt God saying to me, it's not where he wanted me, so I stayed. And then I met my wife. And again, I believe that was, God had a plan and a purpose. Sometimes you don't know. At the time, I didn't know why I was giving up boxing. And then I met my wife, and then I just knew. I knew this is the path that God wants me to take.
So did you find that then? Do you have any pangs? Does it raise its head and think, what would have happened?
Yeah, of course it does. sometimes it does, yeah. I mean, at the time, and I was still thinking, should I go professional and all that? And I never did. I think, I don't know what it is. You want to just push yourself, don't you? But there's people now on the telly and that. And I watch the lads, some of the lads who I was on the squads with. There's a couple of lads who were boxing who I was on the squads with and that. And so I was keeping contact and other people and that in the boxing, and they're doing well. And I think, I never think, oh, could have that been me? It's more like, oh, I wonder how far maybe I would have got. But then, what's more important to God is what's more important to me. And it's not about being up there on a pedestal. And I mean, doing something I enjoy in that, and God, it's creating me and giving me these gifts to do. That was giving glory to him. But at the same time, raising a family, a God-fearing family, and devoting your life to God, for me was more. God definitely took me through boxing to teach me discipline, getting up, reading my Bible, like getting up, going for a run, stuff like that. That is embedded into me through boxing. Controlling my anger, just having that release. Boxing was a big part of my life. Do you know what I mean? I've got boxing gloves here for the kids and that. And sometimes I'll take them on it and that. And yeah. It's just because it teaches them so much. Sport teaches does so much good. When Paul talks about, he talks about, doesn't he? He mentions about not punching aimlessly. And he refers to a sport he talks about boxing. And when he says about running, some of the stuff that comes out of the word of God, you can see analogies from the sport and how that works. And so
the sport and the walk as a Christian is very much in parallel lines, very much so. And you've got to make sacrifices as a Christian, and you've got to remember that narrow road is tough. And it's very easy to jump on the wider road. It's very easy to sort of fall in line with what the world wants. So you have to make a kind of disciplined choice to walk that narrow walk. But the persevering, the training that you do, never giving up. You have your highs and you have your lows. You have to learn how to deal with disappointments. And you get little blessings along the way. You've got to listen to your coach. Listen to Jesus, but you have to put it into practice. That's the big thing. You can talk the talk, but you've got to walk the walk, and that's the hard part. And I trip up. We all do.
Yeah,
knowing that, and it keeps you humble as well. So yeah, the sport's terrific. That's why I'm a big believer, it doesn't matter who you are, you should be doing things to keep yourself fit, active, eat right. You've been given a body, look after it. And I think a lot of young people need that sort of discipline. And you get a lot of rewards from it as well.
So how have you been rewarded through your friendship with Ben? Because Ben, you mentioned that when you went to Nigeria, you met up with your dad, and then you were offered the opportunity to fight for Nigeria, but you turned it down, and you ended up meeting your wife. You went to India instead, didn't you? And you met your wife. And then the best wedding I've ever been to was your wedding. It was beautiful venue, beautiful weather, but I remember just sat in tears during your speech. And for people who know me, I weep a lot. But it was really special. And just some of the things that you put in your cards, especially the card that you sent to Eric about how he'd been like a father figure and a mentor to you. Before we get on to how the blessings that you've had knowing him as a friend, it'd be interesting to hear Eric, the blessings that you had being a good friend with Ben.
Not what we're hearing this, Ian.
He's frozen again because he's so tight. He only spends a fiver on Wi-Fi. So he tags into next door's Wi-Fi. Ben Coppers, you know what they're like.
The chance to be. Can you hear me now?
All right. Can hear you now, mate.
Couldn't you hear me before when I've been rambling on there?
No.
Eh?
We were mocking you. We couldn't hear you, so we just took the mic
out. All right. No, just saying. With my marriage breaking down, that shook me. But I tried to put that emotional energy into being a father figure to the lads I came across, was dealing with in the police, you know? And come across Ben, it was just a natural thing to do, try to guide him. I could see that he needed a few warm truths, you know, and just help him along. And he listened sometimes. But he also made me a good tennis player. That's one thing, you know.
Oh, yeah, go and start with
that. Little rabbit. And, our interest in sport, we sort of understood from that end, the discipline that you needed. Mm.
Because if we look in James, we're called to be people as Christians to look out for the widows and the fatherless. I set a charity up specifically working with the fatherless, looking to get mentors involved in encouraging men in the church to mentor fatherless children, and in particularly fatherless young boys and men. And a lot of people see it as a chore or as an act, but what we see with you is the perfect example of how there's like blessings on both sides, isn't there? Because although you were there to give Ben a few home truths, he also upped your fitness level trying to beat you in tennis. but I just, looking at you, is like, there's so many funny stories I can think of, like when you were sharing a tent and...
Oh, yeah.
having what was it, fig rolls and cups of tea. Marvellous.
Yeah. Marvellous, yeah. Simple things in life, as it was. It was good, yeah, like just stuff, like simple stuff like that. We went to the 2012 Olympics down there, didn't we, Eric? Yeah. And went to watch that in London. You know, we used to go to prisons together. Every now and again, Eric likes me flicking his ears. I don't know why, he's a bit weird like that. But when we first met, we shared a tent together, which was just funny. He was old and his back was hurting him all the time. And I just found it funny. I was just like, I'm getting a great night's sleep. Every morning, he'd be like, oh, my back. You know what I mean? I'd have to help him up sometimes.
Hey, hang on a minute. I remember, I thought, we're going camping, and I thought, I bet he doesn't bring a sleeping bag or something like
yeah.
that. I bet there was a mat to lie on, which he hadn't.
Yeah.
So I'll give him my best mat and I struggle on the other one.
That's what Jesus would do.
I read you like a book.
So what were some of the hassles you've had, like, Eric? Have you ever been pulled over by the police?
Well, yeah, the classic one. I hope this isn't fair, yeah. Yeah, we were driving down a difficult road to negotiate in Stockton. And I was trying to get in this certain lane, and he starts flicking my ear when I'm driving. If anybody's listening to this, Ben has a habit of flicking everybody's ear from when he was a baby, about 2 years previous. And he's flicking my ear, and I'm saying, get off breath, Ben. And I'm looking to try and jump out into this lane. I just jumped out quickly behind this bus, got to the difficult junction, negotiated it, and then a blue light flashes behind us and pulls us up. Having a go at me pulling out like I did, you know, and I was trying to explain to him. Anyway, he let me off the bobby, and I jumped in the car and I just bit his ear off. I said, you know, I bit his ear off. I said, don't you ever do that to me again.
Then you,
of course, he just said it's a big laugh, doesn't he?
Yeah, I reckon that's one of the blessings I've been to Eric. Like, I think once he met me, he chilled out. That's what, you know what I mean? Yeah.
Story of my life, actually. I always meet, it's like a double act wherever I go. I come across a character like you, we just bounce off one another.
I remember just after that had happened, we were meeting in the pub, and Eric walks in fuming, absolutely livid, and tells us a story, and you're stood there, and then you just like go over and tickled his ear and went, "Chill out, Eric."
The only one we're going in a school, mention the kids, we get one on one of these kids, me and him, the ones who are having difficulties at school and being disobedient and everything like that. And Ben's going around flicking their ears. And they're looking at him carrying on. I thought, I don't know who I'm mentoring here, him or you.
Mate, you should see me at work. I still do it at work now.
Yeah.
People just look at me.
Yeah. I can't believe you're still in employment, mate.
Well,
you say that he's done well, the lad, hasn't he? He's done well.
Done all right, I'm not well. You see, mentors, good mentors, you see. Yeah.
Not over yet, though.
Mate, I'm going places. I'm going places.
So what is it you're doing now, Ben?
So what I do now is I flick people's ears professionally. I work for the NHS as a
surgeon.
Patient.
Are you a surgeon? Are you? All right.
He's saying hello.
Hello.
Just let out the cupboard.
I bet you could tell a few stories.
Oh yeah, yes, you could, yeah. So are you finished? Right. So yeah, so what was I saying there? Lost my train of thought.
How about your job?
Oh, my job, yeah. So I work in the mental health hospital. probably not right for me, like, isn't it? just let me out, is it? No, so yeah, I work there with doing maintenance. I did a mechanical apprenticeship when I was younger, and then I went there for the NHS, and I've been there for about 8 years. But in there, I've become God's taught me through the boxing. God's taught me through life. You know, being around yourselves and that. I was able to do well and progress in there, and I've just gone back to college to do an HNC, which I'd never ever go back and do. I left school with no qualifications. You'd spell fudge with my grades, and I've ended up going back to college. It's mad, isn't it? Getting an HNC. So yeah, but now like I'm in. I supervise. Engineers, electrical, mechanical, builders, and got a team of about 50 of all ages and all sizes and characters. It's a good job. I enjoy it. It's a good people. Shared my faith numerous times and supported many of the lads through the hard times that they've been going through. But yes, no, I enjoy it, really, really enjoy it. But who'd have thought, eh?
What do you think is like the biggest lesson that the church can learn then regarding discipleship for men from our background? Because Eric, it's interesting. A lot of people say, oh, we're working class. We grew up on a council estate. But like you recognise, growing up on a council estate in the 60s is completely different to growing up in the 90s, never mind growing up today. I think it's even harder today. So what lessons could be learned by the church for discipleship with young men and women from our estates?
Yeah, I think for me, first church that I went to was a middle-class church, and it was a bit weird, actually, because I went in there, it was all white people. There was a few Africans in there as well, African part of the congregation, but mainly predominantly white doctors, nurses, you know what I mean? And at that time, I was like a youth off a council estate, rough and ready. And it was a bit weird because it sort of stirred loads of fear or anxiety, or I don't know, because they were different and I thought they wouldn't judge me and stuff. But in time, I realised, oh no, you know, they just want to love me. But, you know, I think that your church should reflect, you know, the people who you're trying to meet, really. And I think at the time in the church, there wasn't many people I could relate to, and I didn't think they got me. You know, but over time, you know, they did, and they wanted what's best for me, and they loved me. And Peter Conroy was a great mentor as well. You know, he was very close. So I don't know, it's a tough one. What do we think the church can learn about? I just think about, you know, the church is inclusive, isn't it? And I think, I don't know, I just think having people similar can help, but then also having people who aren't from that same background, they still have, one thing I learned was, you know, there's people there who've got mum and dads, and they've still, their kids have still had, you know, you know, they're different. He's different, totally different to mine, but they've still had their difficulties.
I think you've got to be real with people. You know, the people you, you know, there's more broken families now, and I saw very early on that young men definitely need a father figure. And is this screen frozen again?
Yeah, but I'm here.
You can hear me all right. Yeah.
Yeah.
So you need a father figure, and I think being real with them, and when they know that you genuinely care, and you can't fool some of these people, you know, you can play at it, but if you really try to get to know them and show that you're really trying to care, but there's also a point where you've got to just walk away from some people because they can end up dragging you down. You know, first of all, that person has to be willing to change. You know, and you can get some that will come along and they want to get as much out of you as they can, but they're not seriously thinking of changing. And you have to recognise that. And sometimes comes a point, sometimes you can only do so much, but you can't do anything. It's God, really. They have to have that willingness. And you can only, but as I say, sow the seeds into their lives. And it's whether they react to that or not. We all have that choice. And you persevere to a point, I think. I always remember hearing Jackie Pullinger, when she came over to speak, the woman that works in Hong Kong with the drug addicts. And she has some of the addicts that have come over to Christianity with her. And she said when they take these lads in, she said they treat them like babies for 6 weeks. And then after that, they more or less start releasing them and saying, you're on your own now. It sounded like tough love, but it's what you have to do. You can't be spoon-feeding them all the time, and you've got to steer them in the right direction, but it's up to them then to if they're willing enough, it's possible. Oh. And it's just trying them to get to realise that. You're just trying to guide them on the right path.
It's like, what we're seeing is like genuine relationships, genuine friendships. It's not like you're there as a social worker to fix somebody. Yeah. You're there to walk alongside them, aren't you? And it's a mutual thing. Like we've seen, there's like a mutual friendship between you both. There's mutual blessing, mutual respect. And you both can like speak into each other's lives.
Whether it's like my sport.
Ben cheering you up.
It is, but I mean, if you hadn't, with the sport, you know, I mean, I could have gone, probably done a lot more with it, but I probably would never have found God like I have. And when I was just out today walking with a friend and talking, and I'd looked up a couple of people I knew from the Australia days and what they're doing, and they've been all over doing different football things. I was thinking, well, I could have been doing that and more. But then I thought, I'd rather be where I am, knowing who I know now, and makes life all the more worthwhile, what you're doing.
Yeah, man. Well, I'd love to have you both on and just to hear your testimonies, how you both came to faith in more depth. So that's something for the future. I'll get you on individually, but it's been great chatting with you both.
Plenty of stories about we can tell about you as well, isn't there?
Yeah.
That's one way, you know.
I can think of one right now.
how to take a tent down?
Ambulance! It's an ambulance.
Yeah. I don't know anyone else who stabbed themselves through the palm of the hand taking the 10 pound.
Remember when you ripped your bicep?
Yeah.